So there's once a man who lived who has many stories written about him. He overcame low odds of being selected to the highest position in his country. This is when others said it was impossible. He always had the attitude of, it's possible. He was extremely patient, resilient, even when he was being pursued by the highest authorities. He kept his faith that someday he'd even be delivered from those highest authorities. Once delivered, he brought his country great success among their enemies. He also suffered much grief due to the sins of adultery and murder. A son was born dead, or died after being born, from an affair. Later, his son raped a daughter. A son killed a brother. And two of his sons tried to steal the kingdom from him. And yet through all that, he was faithful. He was repentant. He was sorrowful for his ways. And was strong. He received a promise from the Almighty to be his king, his all-time king, over his people. Some would say he was a myth. Some would say he was a legend. Others would say he was a man after God's own heart. So today I'm going to be going to show you some of the character traits of David and read about his responses to difficult situations from what you might call his own journal, titled David, A Man Who Lived His Life. So I always think of it as Psalms as like his journal. I mean, he obviously wrote down his thoughts and ideas. David was a man who he was the youngest of eight sons, youngest of Jesse, and he had eight or seven older brothers, and he was yet selected to be the king ahead of all those brothers, which we know in tradition and culture in those times, being the youngest, you generally had probably the lowest standing among everyone, right? But yet he was selected to be the king. He demonstrated his great bravery by defeating Goliath in battle. And you think that's okay, that's a great story. But to think about it in terms of you are one of the people out there and this battle-hardened guy who's been in many wars, many battles, toughest guy of everyone, even among the Philistines. And yet he says, you know what? I'm not a man of war. He wasn't a man of war at that time. He was a shepherd. He says, but I'm not going to allow God name to be besmirched, and he was faithful. And yet he went out and with God's help defeated that giant. He went on to serve as a king faithfully, even after he was a fugitive. And you think about being a fugitive, this is we read these stories and we think this is kind of fun, but to live it though, to think about how he lived during that time must have been extremely difficult. Never to have a home, always looking over your shoulder, who's going to be selling me out, who it's going to be taking place. You have new people coming into your camp. This has been a very difficult time for him to be thinking through this, to think that he was the guy responsible for all these people being uprooted and taken into the wilderness. But yeah, he still stayed strong. And he never refused to kill Saul, even though Saul was the guy who was responsible for putting him on the run. He had that obligation. And even mourned his death. That was the one thing about David. You look at the way he talked about Saul's death too. It's different. He was a different person. And when I think of David, I always, out of fun, I say, well, if you had to have a Mount Rushmore of biblical people, and you know, on ESPN, they'll talk about, you know, who's your biblical, or they'll talk about your Mount Rushmore of athletes. And, you know, they'll put on there, you know, Muhammad Ali and Michael Jordan, and all these kind of fancy folks like that. And I always think, well, who's my Mount Rushmore of biblical characters? And I always tell people, Jesus can't be one of them. You know, he's above that. So you can't use him. Everyone goes to that point. But David's on mine. And some people are kind of taken back by that because of some of the problems he had in his life. But always when you really dig into his story, it's just a fascinating human being. Sometimes when you're listening to sermons and you get other ideas, you start thinking of ideas kind of come up. Inspiration happens. And one came for me was that the historical accounts of David are in Psalms and they're in Kings. But there's, you know, there's also the other side of it, which is his journal, which is Psalms, right? And the two, what got me thinking was that one is a historical account. This is what took place, this is what happened, this is who was involved. And the other is more the emotional side of it, of how he felt being the person involved with it. And I thought, if the best we could do, and it's not as easy as I thought it would be, but, you know, let's try to tie the two things together. Like, this is what happened, and this is the psalm that kind of went around that same time. So it was kind of interesting to go through that part and to do that. So we're going to try to look through that. But keep in mind, David wrote these not then and there, but in the here and now. He wrote them in the here and now. He felt the emotions. He felt everything that he was going through. Just like we do. He was as human as any one of us was. Put his pants on, if they wore pants back then like we did, one leg at a time. But at the end of the day, David's life was written in color. Right? You've heard that song. It was, you know, they lived their lives in color or something like that. You know, we think of people way back then as being black and white, or at least in shades of brown and gray, right? No, it was in color just like we are today. So try to think about that when you read through these things. The first characteristic of David I wanted to talk about and highlight today is that he was humble. David was humble. We'll look at 1 Samuel 16. We're not going to be going through this chronologically today, but, you know, we'll bounce around a little bit here and just looking at characteristics, not timelines so much. But in 1 Samuel 16, verse 1, states, "When David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba the servant." Or excuse me, I'm in 2nd. 2 Samuel does not make sense when you're at this point. We'll go back to 1 Samuel 16. 1 Samuel 16. Now, here we are. "Now the Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go, and I'm sending you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite. For I have provided myself a king among his sons.' And Samuel said, 'How can I go if Saul hears it? He will kill me.' But the Lord said, 'Take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Then invite Jesse to sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me the one I name to you.' So Samuel did what the Lord said and went to Bethlehem, and the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, 'Do you come peaceably?'" And I always think about this is that I think Samuel must have been a really nice guy, but he must have been a very stern man too, because when he walked into a place, people were wondering, oh boy, here's the boss, what's going on? So that's kind of what I picture, is that if you've ever worked somewhere where the boss didn't visit very often, when they did, this is probably that same kind of thing. Like, oh, why are you here today? So that's what they're good. "Do you come peaceably?" Verse 5, "And he said, 'Peaceably I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice.' Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So it was, when they came, he looked at Eliab and said, 'Surely the Lord's anointed is before him.' But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see a man as he sees, for the man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" And I always think about this part. This is an important note. You know, we see throughout the Bible, he's not a respecter of persons. We see all these kind of things. And this is, he looks at the heart. And one of the things that with Saul, we know that Saul must have been a very tall, strong, he looked the part. If Hollywood was casting a king, it sounds like from what you read in the Bible, is that Saul probably would have got it based on the way he looked. But that didn't work so well, did it? And God's saying, yep, Eliab, he looks the part, you know, good looking, tall, strong guy. Not what I'm looking for. I'm looking at the heart. So verse 8, he says, "So Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before. And he said, 'Neither has the Lord chosen this one.' Then Jesse made Shema pass by. And then he said, 'Neither has the Lord chosen this one.' Thus Jesse made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, 'The Lord has not chosen these.'" For whatever reason, Jesse's looking at all of them. Here's my first 7. And Samuel's like, "Oh, there's anyone else here. There's got to be someone else here. The Lord didn't send me for just no reason. What's going on?" And Jesse must not have thought that David was ready. So David was not up at the starting lineup, you might say. He was on the bench. Verse 11, and Samuel said to Jesse, are all the young men here? Then he said, there remains yet the youngest, and there he is, keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we'll not sit down till he comes here. So he sent and brought him. Now he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is the one. Then Samuel took the horn of the oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel arose and went to Ramah. We look at that and we see this is what happened. This was what took place. All right, that's a historical account. So we start taking a look at, you know, what David might have been writing about at that point in time. We look at Psalms. So we go to Psalms. Psalms 19. Psalms 19. And we look at the David might have been writing about at this point. What would have been on his mind? The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech or language where the voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of the chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end, and there's nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults, he writes here. Cleanse me from secret faults. He knows there's something. He's talking about how great God is at this point, not about how great he is or patting himself on the back and how happy he is about being anointed king and having all these things happen to him that he wasn't expecting. He's talking about how great God is, how great his law is, how great his creation is up to this point. And then he says, hey, well, by the way, I need to be cleansed from my secret faults. Which atonement is one of the things why we keep atonement, right? Is cleansing us from these secret faults. Keep back, he goes on in 13, keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. And presumptuous sins are sins because of pride and arrogance. So these are more the external ones that we know about. And we know that as a king, many of kings in history, and we can just read through Kings and Chronicles to read this too, how many kings that Israel have that had arrogance and pride and went down very bad, had led Israel to some very bad places. So David knows these things, which is why he was such a good king, is that he knew he had secret sins, but he also had these problems that he wanted to steer clear of, which was presumptuous sins. And he says on this presumptuous sins in verse 13, let them not have dominion over me. Don't let them lead me, because pride and arrogance can lead you to make decisions, say things you don't want to do things you don't want to do, and lead to destruction. And he knows this. He says, then I shall be blameless, and I shall be innocent of great transgression. He wants to be innocent of these things. That's the heart that we all want. That's the heart that God saw, obviously, and we're getting into his character a little bit. Verse 14, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Meaning the thoughts of his heart, the thoughts of his mind, what he's thinking about, let it be acceptable to you. Now, how often do we get on this path of things that are not acceptable in our thoughts? And we think, boy, you know, get off of that mindset, that track that I'm thinking of, and you have to consciously tell yourself this. And he's saying here, help me to be focused in a way that's acceptable to you, God. And we see this. This is a way of living that it's just that David obviously impressed God with. The words that were written down as a sight into it, as a look into his heart. So we're looking also into it. We'll look at Psalms 8. This is also guessed to be around the same time. So we look at Psalms 8 to look at a little bit more about what were the thoughts pouring out of David's heart at the time that he was anointed king. It says here, O Lord, and this is Psalm 8, O Lord, O our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him the glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea that pass through the plants of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. I think we have a psalm that talks about that, right? Or in the hymnal. So he talks about man in this case. The word man in this verse comes from the Hebrew word which means weak or insignificant man. Weak or insignificant man. David could not imagine how God, so mighty and so wonderful and so powerful, could descend to fellowship with sinful, weak, and insignificant folks. That's how he saw himself. He knew who he was. He was weak in the flesh and insignificant compared to God. But yet, he always was rejoicing in God. So how would... One of the things when I was looking up this and something I came across was how sometimes this was used, this psalm was used historically by God's people, in particular like Israel and after that. So it says, when a dedicated Jew was feeling proud of himself, he would run to the shelter of humility around and found in the 8th psalm. When he felt superior, he would go in the field at nighttime and quote or sing this psalm. Perhaps when he became proud, he would find in the 8th psalm a place of humbling as we view the greatness of God and his handiwork in the weakness of human flesh, that we can shout Hosanna because such perfection desires to visit and fellowship with such weakness. God so great, so powerful, so amazing, but yet cares about us and has placed us over parts of his creation. Yeah. You look at, we certainly haven't tamed the universe, but you know, here on earth, he's put us in charge of a lot. For some reason, he still thought a lot of us. Other thing about him, we talked about he's humble now. We've read some things of how he felt about himself, being a weak and fleshly human being. But he was also brave. He's also very brave. And we could always go to David and Goliath and read about how brave he was. But there's also other stories that talk about it, too. So we'll read something else just to break it up. Let's go to 1 Samuel 30. We obviously know the story of how he took on Goliath and tried the king's armor on, and that didn't work. It didn't fit. And he's out there with basically a sling, and he cast a rock and killed the giant. Well, that was obviously very brave. But what other instances was he brave? 1 Samuel 30. And this is where David was on the run and decided he wanted to have some stability in his life for him and his people. So they go to the Philistine king and they asked, or he gave Ziklag to them. It was a city, and they lived in there, and it was their home while they were on the run from King Saul. At this one of the points, they were out raiding some of the tribes that would go up historically against Israel. It was burned, and everyone was taken away. So we're going to pick up and reading in that part, but just kind of give you a little background there. 1 Samuel 30. Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south, and Ziklag attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, their daughters had been taken captive. Now that must have been a sight to come over the hill, see the smoke, and to not know any idea what was going on at that moment. What's going on? and you can have the worst thoughts in your head. I mean, even if you're just driving up to your house and you're off on a business trip and you come home and your whole family's there and you see the place burning, what must be going in your heart and mind at that moment? So put yourself in their shoes a little bit. Strong emotions are being elicited at this moment. Verse 4, then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. Now we read that, and we read it in probably less than 5 seconds. But they wept until they had no more power to weep. I mean, this must have went on for a long time. They were very sad, very sad. And David's two wives, Ahinoam and the Jezreelites, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite, had been taken captive. So even David was just like everybody else. His family was gone. Now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his son and his daughter. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. So at this point, the people were done. They're sick of being out in the wilderness on the run from their homeland. And on top of it, they just came back from battle, and no doubt they're tired, and this is what they come back to. Thanks a lot for your leadership, David, is what they're probably thinking. This is what you've led us to, having our families presumptuously killed, murdered, hauled off into slavery. Who knows what happened to our families? They didn't know. And they're just done with David at this point. They turned to him and said, stone that man. We're going to get rid of him. We're going to be done with this whole thing. And David, what did he do? It's what we all should do in these moments when you have great stress. When life is, presumably, everyone's against you at this moment. You should be strengthening yourself in the Lord. And that's what he did in this moment. That's bravery. Bravery to stand up and strengthen yourself. And he pushes back. He pushes back on the group and rallies them. Now let's jump to 21, verse 21. Now, David, in between this point, they basically found the Amalekites, they killed them, they got their families back. Everything's good, right? Everything's good. Except for of the 600 that he had, 200 were maybe a little older, maybe a little tired, maybe a little wore out, dehydrated, whatever it was, they got left back. And the 400 went forward to take back their families. So at this point, we're in 21, they're coming back. Now, David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow. David, whom they had also who had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near, the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, because they did not go with any of us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. At this point, David's got to be just absolutely mentally wore out at this point. And he has these people rise up within a 600 who says, these folks who didn't go to battle with us, they stayed back and took care of things while we were gone. Forget them. We're not giving them anything. Anyone else who says any different probably started bullying them a little bit about the whole thing. But very selfish attitude, no doubt, at this moment. What was David's response? Quite easy, it's at this point to say, boy, I tell you, these people are really mad early. They wanted to stone me. They're all tired. We're all wore out. Yeah, you're right. Just let them have their children, but they're not going to get the spoils of war. And keep in mind, your houses are burned down. Everyone's things been taken. Who knows what you got left? So having these spoils of war is going to be an important part. Verse 23, but David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as the part of all, the part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. So it was from that day onward. Forward, he made a statue and an ordinance for Israel to this day. So this was something David said, this is the way it's going to be going forward. Doesn't matter if you're staying back, taking care of things, or you're in a forward-facing position, and you're in the heat of the battle, everybody is going to share alike in these things. That was a strong statement he made. in this part, particular part. Let's look at Psalms 145. Psalms 145. Psalms 145, verse 1, I will extol you, my God, O King, and I will bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you, and I will praise your name forever and ever. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise your works to another, and shall declare your mighty acts. I will meditate on the glorious splendor of your majesty, and on your wondrous works. Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. They shall utter the memory of your great goodness and shall sing of your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger and great in mercy. The Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his works. All your works shall praise you, O Lord, and your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of your glory, of your kingdom, and talk of your power to make known his sons of men, his mighty acts, and the glorious majesty of his kingdoms. Your kingdom is everlasting kingdom, is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures throughout all generations. The Lord upholds all who fall and raises up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look expectantly to you, and you give them their food in due season. You open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing. The Lord is righteous in all his ways, gracious in all his works. The Lord is near to all who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth. He will fulfill the desire of those who fear him. He also will hear the cry and save them. The Lord preserves all who love him, but all the wicked he will destroy. My mouth shall speak the praise of the Lord, and all flesh shall bless his name, his holy name, forever and ever. And that's his attitude towards this time when he's went through a very stressful time. His thoughts are, God's there for you. He delivers you in these strong moments. If you stand by God, he's with you. His mercies, strengths, all these things he talks about here. That's his mindset. And I think if we're thinking and we go through tough times, no one's had more tough, challenging times than David. I can say, well, we could say at least the folks in this room, and I would say we'd be hard-pressed to have beat David on some of the challenging trials he had in his life. But this is his attitude. This is the way he talks about his experiences. And I think that's important as we're looking at it, that we have that same thought. The next thing after he's brave, he's humble, he's also a remorseful person. A remorseful person. Now, David admitted he was not a perfect person. He never said he was, never tried to say he would be. And we see, how did he handle when he made mistakes? 2 Samuel 11. Start verse 1. It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when David, when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. So for whatever reason, there was a season for war, and they were in it. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked down the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is it not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So at this moment, David was lusting after and coveting after a woman. It was not his wife, it was someone else's wife. That's the first sin we have here. Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and they lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. It's also second sin here, adultery. And the woman conceived, so that she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." Then David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how how the war was prospered, and how's the weather, and how's the kids, and you know, how's your brother doing, you know, and just trying to make small talk with the guy, in other words. Sure, it has to have been very uncomfortable for David knowing what he knew. And David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house and all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? And just to think, the other sin here is that he's covering up. He's deceiving. He's lying, in other words. He's being deceptive. Verse 11. And Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. It must have been he must have been a high character individual. Uriah was a high character individual. And he must have been someone who valued his position within the army. He valued the men who served with him and under him. And he had a very strong feeling of, it's not right that I'm here with all my men, everyone I'm fighting with are in the trenches, and here I am going to go lie with my wife and eat great food from the king. Just isn't right. I can't do this. So that gives you a little idea about Uriah in this case. Very high character individual, at least it's seemingly so. Verse 14, in the morning it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by hand of Uriah. And he wrote the letter saying, set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him, that he may be struck down and die. And he did. That's murder. Well, maybe he didn't directly do it, but that's conspiracy to commit murder. That is first-degree murder. And if anyone knows that, if you know the law, it doesn't matter that if you're the person who pulls the trigger or you're part of it, you're generally equally guilty of it all. So, in this particular case, David was guilty of murder. Verse 26. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became the wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David did had done displeased the Lord. And obviously displeased the Lord. He said, this is the guy I selected. I put you in this position. I've taken care of you all this way. And this is how you act right here. We'll go into 2 Samuel 12, verse 1. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, there were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with the children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And the traveler came to a rich man who refused to take from his own flock, from his own herd, to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die. Nathan hit that right on the head, didn't he? Nathan must have really been an exceptional individual with his words, with his delivery, with the choice that God put in the story that God put in his heart. And he got David exactly where he had him. He has David right in the palm of his hand, doesn't he? And he's getting ready to lower the boom here. Verse 6, and he shall restore four, who has done this shall surely die. Verse 6, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity. On top of it, he didn't even feel bad about the whole thing. This guy's really got to pay for this thing. Boy, David was really laying it on thick here, wasn't he? Verse 7, then Nathan said to David, you are the man, thus says the Lord God of Israel. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me. You have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. And if you look at what happened with Absalom, even though he forgave him, he followed through on his promises. Verse 12, for you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all, before the sun. Verse 13, so David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin, you shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme the child also who is born, shall surely die. Excuse me. Then Nathan departed to his house, and the Lord struck the child and Uriah's wife bore to David, and it became ill. David therefore pleaded with God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night on the ground. So he does a complete 180 degrees here. I mean, he's obviously been living this way, been prideful, proud of probably feeling like, hey, I got from underneath this. No one's called me out on it yet. No one's talked to me about it yet. And if it this far along in the pregnancy, you're at 9 months, and you can say probably at around 2 months, everything took place. For 7 months, at least six, half a year, David had been sitting there thinking, whew, I outsmarted them all on this one, didn't I? You know? And God was just waiting. It's like, at some point, probably God was hoping, would he just repent? Would he just come back to me? And God finally had to send Nathan in. So, Psalm 51, we just sung it, actually. As we were singing, I said, well, that's good timing. Psalm 51. When you're singing that psalm, I mean, you can, it kind of brings out, especially if you're singing it around Passover, you get the emotions of that, because none of us are perfect and all of us have sin that we have to be cleansed from. Psalm 51's very touching. Verse 1, have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. If anyone's ever committed a mistake, and something that, you know, is fairly large enough that's going to be weighing on you, and everyone knows that feeling of it's always before me. It's always at the front of your mind. You can't get rid of it. You can't shake it. And that's where David was. He had it right before him, could not shake it. Against you and you only have I sinned and done evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts, and in hidden parts you will make me know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out my iniquities. And if anyone's gone through a trial and a tough time, and you're repenting, you're just trying to get beyond your sins, that if you've repented, God's already scattered them. But sometimes it's hard for us to get rid of them. And you just can't find that joy of living again. And this is what David said, make me hear joy and gladness. Make me feel good about life again. That's what he's hoping. He feels broken. He's beaten up. Verse 9, hide your face from my sins and blot out my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. And we read earlier that God gave him his Holy Spirit. And he knows that Saul had it removed. Saul had it taken away. And we saw what happened to Saul after he became a very paranoid and just wicked person. So David, don't take it from me, please. Verse 12, restore to me the joy of your salvation and uphold me by your generous spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners shall be converted to you. David wants to feel good. He wants to be teaching people. He wants to help people understand their ways are bad too. Verse 14, deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God, the God of my salvation, and my tongue shall sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifice of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. And we know in other parts, in other scriptures, it says God doesn't want all these sacrifices. The sacrifices themselves are not what he wants. What he wants is a sacrifice of your own heart, being contrite, broken, sad, repentant. That's what God wants. That's what he really wants. And that's what he's getting from David. That's what he's getting in David in this moment, exactly what he hoped to get. He's seeing a man who's broken, who's sad, he's contrite. Verse 18, do good in your good pleasure to Zion. Build the walls of Jerusalem. Then you shall be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with burnt offerings and whole burnt offerings. Then they shall offer bulls on your altar. So this is David. This is who they call this a penitential psalm, and meaning it's atoning psalm. This is a psalm that is used, at least maybe still is, among the Jews and among others, looking, you know, to when you too have had sin, when you too have had issues. This is a psalm that you can go back to and you can read and you can do it in prayer. And one of the things, if you look at study and prayer, you can always take and you can read these psalms in prayer, and ones that really hit home your attitude, your feeling, your emotions. You can read these. And these moments, you know, help you sometimes get the words out of your mouth. And then maybe start you thinking about other things you want to say, because sometimes David just was a master craftsman with words. He was obviously a poet, and he was an exceptional writer. David was a unique individual, and I would say an artist at his core, obviously a musician too. So poetry, musician, a very, I would say, probably tender-hearted person in a lot of ways. And so God obviously saw a lot of things in him. And, you know, anyone knows musicians and artists and people like that generally have a more tender side to them. And obviously David did. And this is something that when you read these things, you can take that upon you and help you to have that same tenderheartedness. And this was also used by Jews that they would read it. The other thing he was strategic. He was strategic. So he wasn't just an artist, you know, who would go into coffee shops and do poetry slams, and everyone would click their fingers, if you've seen those before. He wasn't that kind of guy also. He was also a very serious man. He 2 Samuel 15, we'll read about this. Very, probably low point of his life. And if we thought that the low point of his life was adultery and murder and sin and all these things, well, it just got worse. And this is, part of it was probably the promise that God would keep the sword over his home, and that he would always, he had a hard time finding peace throughout his life. And for a lot of it, some would say maybe it was to keep him humble so that he wasn't getting too prideful and proud. But in this case, this must have been very hard. Anyone who has a son could probably appreciate this. 2 Samuel 15, verse 1. After this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever one who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." What a shame. This is too bad. You know, Absalom's saying that, just too bad. I wish there's someone to hear your case in this thing. Verse 4, moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I, Absalom, would give him justice. Verse 5, and so it was whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He was a good politician, in other words. This guy was one of the best. If you've seen some really good ones in your time, this was probably one of the best right here. This guy knew how to curry favor with the people. First of all, tell them what they want to hear. Just too bad you can't get the judgment yet. You got a good case here. You got a great case. I think you should win. One of the best cases I've ever read of or heard of. But it's not going to get done. It's just too bad. But if I was king and I was the judge, I would take it up and I would give you justice. That's basically what he was saying in this particular case. Now it came to pass after 40 years, verse 7, that Absalom said to the king, please let me go to Hebron and pay vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And the king said to him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along instantly and did not know anything. Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel and the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, from Gila, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. So he was very good, very strategic. Absalom was very smart in how he was executing this particular part. And it was obviously paying off. Verse 13. Now a messenger came to David, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. And the king's servant said to the king, We are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. So this is a very tough time. David has found out his son Absalom is leading a coup against him and is taking over. And his response is, we better get out of here. Sounds like they got the edge on us. We better get going. Verse 30, jump down to 30. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up, and his head covered, and went barefoot, and all the people who were with him covered his heads and went weeping as they went. And someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. That's the first thing he says here. He knows that this guy's good, but please turn it into foolishness. This is one of his best advisors. Now it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshiped God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. And at that time, when your robes are torn and dust on your head, you're sorrowful, you're sad. He obviously is not feeling very good about the situation. David said to him, if you go with me, then you'll become a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I'll be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant previously, so I will now also be your servant. Then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And do you not have Zadok and Abiathar the priest with you there? Therefore it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall tell Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Indeed, they have there with them the two sons, Ahimaaz and Zadok's sons, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. And you can read more about this, but this worked. This absolutely worked. The strategy worked. He put spies in Absalom's court. And if you're Absalom, you really don't know at this point, because you can't afford to have a complete 100% turnover of key staff leaders. If you're trying to become king, you need to have some people around you still helping you out. And David knew this. David knew that he would have to plant some people within the administration. And we see it today, even in government. People are always doing it, even in today's government. There's plants in government, people you think you can trust, but you can't. And David's using this strategy. And it worked. Some things to think about this is that, and you read the stories that they eventually, one of the advisors David had planted actually was, his advice was taken, and they waited till David could get across the river. And then once he got across the river, he was able to hold up long enough to gain some strength, get some supplies, get his army put in place, and eventually they went to war against Absalom and won. That's a good story, but it shows you into David's mind that some of the things he was thinking about, and that he was a very successful leader. And that's why, and Absalom should have known that it wouldn't have been so easy. I mean, here's David who's been battle-hardened for many, many decades, and that he was smart also. George Patton often said, fixed fortifications are a monument to stupidity of mankind. Unless supplied from the outside and defended capably, a besieged city will fall to any determined and competent attacker. And David knew that. David knew that if he held up in Jerusalem and tried to fight off Absalom, it would have been just a bloody battle in the streets. People would have died. But he was able to pull them out into the countryside and had a battle there. So David was very smart, very wise, and you can see he was very strategic also. So what about it? Psalm 3. Get some of the corresponding psalms that go with it. Lord, how they have increased who troubles me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. At this point, David's saying, he has no hope. He's done. He's a dead man, in other words. And he feels like everywhere he turns, there's someone against him. That's his attitude, his heart. That's at least the way he feels at this moment. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. And who knows how many Absalom had had. Verse 7, rise, O Lord, save me, O God, for you have struck all my enemies in the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is upon your people. At one of the weakest moments he probably had, having a son betray him, try to steal the kingdom right out from underneath him. And he's sitting there talking about how great God is and how great God is going to deliver him and has delivered him. And that's the attitude he's taken on. And that's a hard attitude to have, you know, when you don't know from where your enemies are coming from or where they're at. It's a really hard thing to have. But he was there. The final thing that we're going to look at here is that David was loyal. He was a loyal individual, 1 Samuel 24. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that he told him, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of Engedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road there, where there was a cave, and Saul went to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. This must have been a very cavernous cave. They said 600 people were with them somewhere in there. To have 600 people in a cave must have been very cavernous. So he came to the sheepfolds, verse 4, then the men of David and him said to him, this is the day of which the Lord has said to you, behold, I will deliver the enemy into your hands, that you may do this as it seems good to you. And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterwards that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up and went from the cave and went on his way. So all Saul, you know, David cut off a corner to prove that he could have killed him. And he goes on to tell, you know, cries out from the cave and says to him, look, I could have killed you and I didn't. And I think that must have been a moment for Saul to think about that too. Is like, wow, you know, I could have been killed and this guy who I think is just absolutely after me didn't. So I think there's also must have been some really bad counsel around Saul also who perpetuated and fed into this because of jealousy of David. And we know any strength, there must have been some people around who did not want David around because he represented change and represented new leadership. And so Saul must have got the wheels turning. But that's something that you'd want to read too, is read through that whole story and how David handled himself there. We'll turn to Psalm 57. Psalm 57. It says here, this is a mictum of David when he fled from Saul into the cave. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you. In the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed. I will cry out to the Most High, to God, who performs all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongues are sharp sword. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have dug a pit before me. In the midst of it, they have themselves have fallen. And this is the way people would trap people, and by digging pits and covering it. Verse 7, my heart is steadfast, O God, my heart is steadfast. I will sing and give praise. Awake my glory. Awake my lute and harp. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing to you among the nations, for your mercy reaches unto the heavens, your truth unto the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. And one of the things you see about David, he always starts off talking about just how bad it is, and then he finishes up how great God is to be there with him. And it's okay to acknowledge our realities and situations, but it's also good to transition and realize that God is with you, even in these tough situations. And that's the way his attitude was there. So we can see the character of David clearly. He was humble, he was brave, remorseful, strategic, and loyal. All admirable qualities. And there's many more, but you know, we got so much time here. But he had a lot of good qualities that we can read about. We can read about his attitude in the Psalms and looked at the history side of it, what took place, along with the emotional tie that ties to it. This was just a sampling of the man who's famous among even non-believers. Everyone knows the story of David and Goliath and his famous sports references all the time. So I would encourage you to continue to read about his various events and how he felt about it too. How did he feel about these events that took place in history? There's a reason he's the most documented man in the Bible. Outside of Jesus, of course. But we can learn from him and we can take on the heart of David, the heart of God.